Go ahead and take a seat, please. Gianna Jensen is a nationally known public speaker, an activist, and though she's 40 years old, I think almost without exception, every time she speaks, she talks about the occasion of her birth. Because for her, the story of her birth is very formative for her life. She has the medical records that show that in her mother's 30th week of pregnancy, she went to have an abortion through saline. That abortion, instead of prompting an abortion, prompted the birth of a baby who was subsequently named Gianna Jensen. Have you ever thought about how vulnerable children are? They can't fend for themselves. They don't feed themselves. They don't take care of themselves. They don't provide for themselves. They depend on somebody else to take care of them. And that's under the best of circumstances. Imagine what it would be like to take all of that vulnerability and now to have that child born into a circumstance where the world doesn't want them, where people are actively seeking their death and their destruction, and it doesn't seem very likely that anything good could come out of a context where lives begin with such vulnerability that there's much hope. Today is Father's Day, and perhaps you have a father who, when you were a child, you're most vulnerable, you had a dad who took care of you, and a dad who protected you and provided for you. And if you do, you do have an obligation today to say Happy Father's Day to that person. There are some people today, though, that might say they don't have a father who ever protected them when they were vulnerable. But I hope as we look at our text this morning, we will come to find that all of us do indeed have a father who has watched over us when we didn't know we were being watched over, who cared for us when we didn't realize anyone was caring for us. Now, what would have been perfect in my little world, though the larger world doesn't accommodate mine, is if this was Mother's Day, because Exodus 1 and 2 is a wonderful text about an awful lot of godly women who did wonderful and amazing things. But we do want to look at our text this morning, and in chapter 2, we're going to recognize that there were especially three women who became agents of God and who played a crucial role in making sure that Moses had the opportunity to live when he was most vulnerable and when he was born into a world that did not want him to live. The first chapter of Exodus, we were reminded of the failed attempt, asking the midwives that any time a baby boy was born, that they should be killed. Pharaoh then upped the ante, and he now has commanded that anytime anyone, not just the midwives, sees a baby boy that is born, they need to be thrown into the Nile. And that's the kind of the world that we live in that's there whenever we read of this text in chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman, and the woman conceived. It's not really a great time overall to be having children of any sorts. But when you find out that you're pregnant in the midst of all of that anxiety, what do you think those parents are praying for the duration of the pregnancy? Please let it be a girl. Because if it's a girl, she'll be saved. She'll be rescued from all the destruction and all the death that is around. And so it is at this moment that we wonder what indeed will be born, and we do come to find out that she bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him for 3 months. No one knows exactly how a parent would have acted that moment. They say, congratulations, it's a boy. It's not congratulations, is it? You realize your life is now filled with all of this uncertainty. And the mother sees, and we don't know exactly what the text means whenever it says that he was a fine baby, or that he was handsome, your text may say, or that he was good. All I know is if you're in utero, make sure you comb your hair if your beauty is going to be the sign of whether you get saved or not. But she recognizes something about this child. And she takes a tremendous risk. If you've ever been around 1, 2, and 3 month old babies, you know, they don't always remain quiet when they're supposed to be quiet. And so she takes a risk to protect this vulnerable child until she deems it too dangerous, I think not just for herself, but for this child also. And so we are told that when she could hide him no longer, she took a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitum and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. So the mother is now exhausted with options. And she does something that is likely surprising if we have been reading the Bible from the beginning of Genesis. She puts him in the thing that the Bible describes has only been mentioned once before and will only be mentioned one other time in the Bible, and it's mentioned in Genesis 6:14. She put him in an ark. The exact same thing that God asked Noah to build, this woman now builds. And what did Noah do of that ark? He put bitumen and pitch on it. And she does the same. Now, the thing that we don't know is whether she went and she put the baby there and said, "Boy, good luck to you, son. I'm going to be praying that just like God delivered Noah through the ark, that he will deliver you as well." Or it seems perhaps more likely that this baby is hidden, that really what has happened is the baby's residential address has changed to just down by the bank. And you hide him and the family watches over him. And one day something unexpected happens with the baby that is down by the river. He gets noticed. He catches the eye of Pharaoh's daughter. And there she sees it hiding in the reeds. This is not the baby has been put out to be found. The baby was hidden so that it would not be found. But on this occasion, the baby is found. Perhaps the worst case scenario has just happened. And it is Pharaoh's daughter who takes the child. And the event is described in Exodus 2:6. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrew children," she said. And Moses, of course, at 3 months old, is completely unaware of the significance of this moment. What Pharaoh's daughter chooses to do dramatically impacts whether Moses is ever going to make any other speeches for the rest of his life. Because if she turns him over, if she discards him into the water like she has been commanded by her father to do, this would be the end of the story of Moses. But the text highlights three things that she does and describes her action in this way. Number one, she saw the child. The word to see here is not just about making eye contact or some sort of visual recognition. It's about being a disposition of kindness and sympathy. It's about noticing the way that another is suffering and being moved by it. And this is inferred, but she heard the child because he was crying. And again, we can make ourselves deaf to the sounds of the hurting and the suffering around us in such a way that we no longer hear. And then finally, she took pity on him. So we need to know that this woman is under the command of her father, Pharaoh, who had instructed her to kill this baby boy. And instead of doing what he asked her to do, she took pity on him. And she makes the necessary arrangements to be sure that he is nursed and cared for. And of course, as we read the ironies in the text, we find out that it's Moses' sister who makes the suggestion, who finds Moses' mother, who raises him until he gets old enough. But Pharaoh's daughter would take a risk here of the anger and the fury of her own father so that this vulnerable child can live. And so she takes him as her own, and she names the boy Moses. And what do you think it would be like growing up, knowing that this woman saved you from what would have been certain death for you? You wonder if he ever missed a Mother's Day, he forgot to call Mom on Mother's Day. Do you think that he ever thanked her for saving him when his life was in peril? Do you think that in any way his life was indebted to her? It makes me think of a lady named Dana Mason Warmer. She was adopted as an infant, and when she was in her mid-30s, she looked at her adoption and expressed these words to her parents. And she wrote, "There's never been a time in my life that I didn't know that I was adopted, that I was chosen. My story is a simple one. Though I don't have many details around the exact circumstances of my entering into this world, I know that my mother was a 20-year-old who was not yet ready to raise a child, but was willing to grow and to keep a baby safe for 9 months. My mom and dad had struggled with infertility, and after a casual conversation about adoption with their doctor, the wheels of our collective fate began to turn. I am very aware that my life was a gift given to me by three people, and I do not intend to waste it. I had such a lovely childhood. At Christmas time, mom and dad would say they don't want any gifts, that they have everything they could ever need. And so she says of her parents, "Thank you for choosing me, for waiting for and keeping your hearts open, and for saying yes when that call came. Thank you for keeping me safe for 35 years and counting. I am adopted. I am so very lucky." See, what would it be like to know that at your most vulnerable, somebody chose to take a risk to care for you and provide for you? What would it be like to know that somebody sacrificed so that you could have a better life, or perhaps even somebody sacrificed so that you could even be alive? Do you think that in any way would impact how you live the rest of your life? And it seems to me that as we continue reading Exodus 2, Moses grows up with this awareness that he was saved by the compassion of another person when he was a vulnerable child. And he was raised with this awareness that there are other people who are oppressed and vulnerable, and they too need somebody who will choose for them. And so our text continues into chapter 2, verse 11, when Moses is now all grown up, and he goes out to his people, and he saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinfolk. And now Moses is acting in a way similar to Pharaoh's daughter. Again, he saw. And the language here is not just, you know, this visual recognition, but he felt sympathy towards what his people were suffering, what they were enduring, and what they were going through. And so Moses, like his mothers, sees, and he does something in action in response. Now, you might think this is a very normal activity, that we notice the suffering of people and that we do something about it. But that's not the case of Kitty Genovese. March 13th, 1964, 28-year-old girl, Kitty Genovese, was stabbed outside her apartment building. And her community saw this tragedy and they were disheartened by it until 2 weeks later, the New York Times ran a story that said 38 people had witnessed the stabbing and not a single person called the police or intervened in any single way. See, it's easy from our safe position to say, oh, if I saw somebody vulnerable, I would certainly intervene. But would we? Would we really risk everything that we might try and save somebody who has nothing? And Moses did intervene, and our text tells us that he struck this Egyptian and he killed him. And boy, oh boy, could we get sidetracked by trying to figure this out. Now, one of the things that we do know is that the language is used in most of your English translation says he killed him, but in fact what he did was he struck him. The law will later say in Exodus 21, 12 through 21, that if you strike someone and they die, or if you strike someone they do not die, there's different penalties, which is this understanding that one might hit someone without the intention of them dying. And Moses intervenes, and I think what our text is trying to teach us, with all our kind of our moral awkwardness aside, is that this is in fact a foreshadowing of exactly what God will do to Egypt. This same word for strike will be used another 7 times in Exodus, and in every time God is the one who is striking, and it is Egypt who is stricken by God. So Moses foreshadows this God who sees the ill treatment of his people. When the writer of Hebrews talks about this, he says in 11:25 of Hebrews, of Moses, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Sees this as something righteous and something noble that Moses would risk himself to punishment, to being ostracized, to being exiled. Now we know that the next day, Moses' greatest fear becomes known. When he's in the process of breaking up a fight, they say that what Moses has done is known, and Moses, of course, is forced to flee to the country of Midian. But again, what the writer of Acts, when Stephen is doing his speech, says in Acts 7, 24 through 25, says it this way. When he saw one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his kinfolk would understand that God through him was rescuing them, but they did not understand. What is it like to be that person who sees suffering, who responds, and then you pay the ultimate price for it? Not something too uncommon for Moses. Again, the Pharaoh's trying to kill him, and so he's forced to run to Midian. And perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that when he gets to Midian, he sees a group of women who are being bullied by shepherds. And what does Moses do? Moses got up and came to their defense. Moses seems to recognize, as a person who was saved when he was young and vulnerable, that that becomes a responsibility for the people of God. And I don't think it's until the end of the second chapter that we get a sense of why these stories are being told to us. Because these are stories that embody what God is doing and going to do with Israel. When we read these stories of Moses and of Pharaoh's daughter, what we are doing is, in a very small way, we are experiencing God's relationship with his chosen people. See, Moses acts like God when he tries to save the Egyptians from the Israelites from the oppression of the Egyptians. Moses fails and he's banished. Pharaoh's daughter, even though she's not a person of God, God will use those who are not of his people, that she acts like God when she rescues Moses from the water. She saves that one child. But the human rescues in this story are limited. They cannot do a full and a complete rescue. For that to happen, God will need to intervene, and God himself will need to come to the rescue of his people. And so notice what the summary in chapter 2, verse 23 through 25 says. After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of their slavery, the cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites and God took notice of them. So for the first time in Exodus, God becomes the subject of an action. God has been working behind the scenes, working in ways unseen with these people. But now God is preparing to directly act. And the four things that we recognize that God does. Number one, he heard their groaning. Again, there's noises all around us, but do we hear it? Are we aware of it? God remembers his covenant. To remember means to actively to attend to that which he remembers, which means God is preparing to do something about the promise he made. God looks. This is the same word where God is moved towards kindness and sympathy. And God took notice of them, which means to identify with their suffering. And can you notice the relationship between Pharaoh's daughter and Moses' action and God's action? Seeing and being willing to act on behalf of people. See, these two people act like God with skin on it. And the Israelites will know what it felt like to be Moses in that basket. Because Israel themselves are vulnerable under the Egyptian rule. They will not be able to bring themselves out of this land. They will not be able to feed themselves. They will not be able to care for themselves. They are like an infant in a basket. And just like Noah, who was in that ark, the only way that anybody is saved from this predicament is if and when God chooses to act and when God chooses to bring about his salvation. So what does it feel like to be rescued or to be adopted or for somebody to care for you when you're the most vulnerable? And the Israelites find that answer through experience because God becomes that father who rescues and who delivers them. But there's someone else that we come to find out who knows exactly what it's like to be at their most vulnerable, to be helpless, and to be rescued. And that is us, the New Testament people of God. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 through 7 says, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as children. And because you are children, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a child. And if a child, then also an heir through God. See, whether you have an earthly father who's still living, whether you have an earthly father that you loved or respected, all of us have a father who, when we were vulnerable, he came and he offered us adoption. This is the very God who was born of a woman and who, just like Moses, was threatened at birth when Herod is trying to chase down all the baby boys and to kill them as well. God is vulnerable for us who are vulnerable. When Herod is doing this, the family flees to Egypt. And then when the time is right, the family is brought out of Egypt safely, just like the Israelites before him. When Jesus, the boy, grew up, he heard the groaning of the people. He remembers the covenant of God. He looks upon people, and he acted by giving his life on a cross. The primary difference between Jesus and the Moses figure is that instead of striking the people, Jesus himself allows himself to be the one who is struck. Instead of killing, he himself is the one who is killed on the behalf of those whom he loves. And because of what Jesus did, we can all be called children of God. See, during the time of the New Testament, adoption was not primarily for the sake of the infant or the child or the individual being adopted. It was for the sake of the adoptee. It was almost more like hiring someone for a job. Whoever's the most qualified, that's who you want to adopt, to bring into the family, who will then take care of the family estate. You didn't ever adopt anyone who could contribute nothing to you. You didn't ever adopt anyone who was vulnerable. You didn't adopt anyone who was oppressed. You adopted for your sake, not theirs, until God comes along. And this is the way that it's described in Romans 5:6. For while we were still weak, at the right time God died for the ungodly. When you were vulnerable, when you were in slavery to sin, God saved you out of the basket when you could do nothing. And so as Christians, I don't think we need to ask, what would it be like if when we were most vulnerable, somebody else made a sacrifice to save us? Because we've experienced it. And perhaps the question then we need to ask is, how should that impact the rest of our lives? I think, like Gianna Jensen, whose mom tried to abort her, we should know that we've been saved from death, and therefore we're going to live a life to the glory of God the Father. Like Dana Mason Warmer, we should know that we've been adopted, that somebody chose us. That like Moses, we should realize that we need somebody to rescue us in our weakness, and indeed someone has. And like Israel, we should know that right when we needed a deliverer, God sent one. And so the thing that should typify our lives is praise and thanksgiving, recognizing that on this Father's Day, we have a Father who, when we could do nothing about it, gave us life and hope and salvation. And I think our lives should be an echo of a text I'm about to read, which is Psalm 124. And this scripture is going to serve as our blessing and also as our invitation, because I think it should be a motto of sorts for what God intends for our lives to be. After I read this psalm, if you want to respond, there'll be some folks in the back, and while we're singing the song, you can come back and join us there. But I'd like us to close with a reading of Psalm 124, verses 1 through 8. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, when our enemies attacked us, then they would have swallowed us alive. When their anger was kindled against us, then the flood would have swept us away. The torrent would have gone over us. Then over us would have gone the raging waters. Blessed be the Lord, who has not given us as prey to their teeth. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken, and we have escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. If you'd like to respond, come and do so as we stand and sing this song.
I know.